You ever feel like you're constantly on edge, like the war zone never really left you? Maybe it shows up in your perfectionism, where every mistake feels like life or death. Or maybe it's the pain, physical or emotional, that no one else seems to see. And you want peace, you want control, you want to feel like yourself again, but the chaos inside you just won't quit. This episode could be the fix for that. We're talking with Army veteran Cole Grace, a combat engineer, a bomb tech, and now mental health advocate. Cole opens up about facing IEDs in Iraq and then coming home to fight maybe even a harder battle. The perfectionism, chronic pain, and the spiral into addiction. And so what makes this episode different, right? Cole doesn't just tell his story. He also shares the tactics that helped him rewire his brain and reclaim his life. We talk about things from EMDR to gratitude to debugging the mental code that runs our lives. This is all about transforming the inner chaos into calm. But before we dive in, make sure you're subscribed to the email newsletter at driveonpodcast.com/subscribe. You'll get my 5 favorite episodes sent straight to your inbox. No fluff, just the best insights to help you drive on. I also want to take a moment to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial serves as both a tribute to those who served and a way to ensure their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you want to learn more or find out how you can support their mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now, let's get into today's episode. Hey, Cole, welcome to the show. I'm really looking forward to our conversation, getting into your story and learning some of the lessons that you've picked up along the way. But yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're an Army veteran. You deployed to Iraq. You're a combat engineer. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your experience in the Army, kind of deployments, all the stuff that you experienced there. What was going on with you?
All right. Well, I joined. It wasn't as heroic of a story when I joined, but it was right before 9/11. I joined in July, and I was going to college, and I wanted to go to college. So I joined up, and then 9/11 happened, and I stuck with it, went to boot camp after 9/11. And then it wasn't until 2005 that I deployed, and we deployed to Iraq as route clearance, and we did convoy security and cache sweeps, like looking for weapons. We were stationed in Ramadi, so it was one of the hot spots during that time. And my job was before the robot, so I used to be the demo team. I'd get out of the vehicle after the Buffalo and disarm the IED, and then I would go up, collect the trigger, and then put a C4 charge on it and pull the time fuse and blow up their munitions in place and just traveling throughout Iraq, you know, going under 5 miles, like 3 miles an hour, trying to looking for bombs, and sometimes getting snipers shooting at you while you're working on a bomb or different things. And you still got to go finish blowing up more bombs after that. So it can be intense. And I learned how to like stifle my emotions and still act despite the fear. But it wasn't for a long time that I learned how to deal with those.
Yeah, I got to imagine that's not an easy thing to do. You're working on a very complicated operation where you mess up, you blow up kind of thing. And then, oh yeah, by the way, you got snipers shooting at you too. So, you know, no pressure at getting that job done, right? And, you know, other people are relying on you too. And so that's a big... really, it's a big deal, you know, doing what you're doing. And, you know, that I would imagine that kind of changed you a little bit in terms of how you managed stress, dealt with these situations? You know, did you see yourself kind of evolving while you were over there, or was it like maybe not till after you got home that you realized, hey, this is a different Cole than the guy who left? You know, how did that evolve?
It's a kind of a weird thing that happens when you get over there at first and into that situation. It's like, what? In the first couple of weeks, what is this? How am I going to do this for a year?
Yeah.
It's wild. And then when it starts to become normal, because you have to adapt to it, you do adapt to it. And it just becomes, you know, you become very in tune with your environment and you notice small detail changes. And, you know, we'll talk about it later, but develop perfectionism. Like, you make a mistake, people die.
Yeah.
And that becomes a belief that carries on after, but you don't really notice it while you're there. And then maybe when, like, after being back for a while, start to realize that a lot more intense than I used to be, that, you know, it's, I notice things a lot more, and my brain's constantly moving and ready to act, and it doesn't need to, but.
Right. Yeah. And that's a thing that's common with a lot of folks who come back from a high intensity deployment like the one that you were describing. My younger brother, he was in Iraq in Ramadi in 06, like late, okay. late 05, early kind of 06. He was only there for about 6 or 7 months or so. And he was kind of just augmenting some of the troops that were over there. He was in the Vermont National Guard, but he was saying the same thing. It was like, you know, pretty much on a daily basis, they were taking fire from somebody or hitting IEDs or something was happening. And yeah, you start to have to just notice things around. And it's, I think it's just a survival instinct that kicks in, because, you know, normally on a normal day-to-day basis, you can go to the grocery store and not have to worry about, you know, stepping on a pressure plate or, you know, having something blow up or having a sniper, you know, taking you out in the parking lot or anything right. like that. You know, like none of those things are concerns for people in just normal everyday life. Mm-hmm. But then when it becomes your everyday life, which, you know, it did in your case, then you kind of just get that turned on, that trigger is turned on in your brain. And that's a hard thing to turn off when you learn
that's what you just said.
Yeah. Clicked. You learn a skill to keep you alive. Mm-hmm. Why would you ever want to turn that off, right?
Right, and it's weird that other people don't feel that way. That's what that disconnect was when I got back. All my people that I'm with have that same sense of, you know, urgency, I guess you'd call
it.
And then when you're back home, people are just like, why are you not, you know, because it's not, they don't have to deal with that.
Right. It's almost, you know, from my perspective anyways, and talking to some other people, it's almost enraging when they're not, you know, aware of things going on. It's like, how could you not be, you know, like it's there. You can clearly see it. That could be a dangerous situation. Why are you not paying attention to that? You know, and so when was it that you kind of recognized the effects of what was going on with you? And, you know, was it, you know, all combat related? Were there other things kind of mixed in? What kind of finally helped you realize that there needed to be something addressed, you know, after experiencing all of this?
At first there was bitterness. There was like a built-in justification because I did what I did, that my trauma is worse than anybody else's in my head, you know? And so it was easy for me to, but you didn't do this, you know, you might have, you know? Right. And so for a long time I had that, and it wasn't until I started to, you know, some of my friends went on multiple deployments, and then other people I talked to had like sexual trauma and some other things that realized that. And I started to discover that some of the things that I didn't think were that impactful from childhood actually had more impact than some of the combat stuff that you would think would really. So I started to have this. You shouldn't really measure trauma. There's no good measure for it. So I developed perfectionism really bad. What we're talking about with making a mistake equals death. And that maps back to my childhood. But at first I would only map things back to war trauma. That's really all I gave credence to. In fact, the first time I went to counseling, the counselor started trying to talk about childhood stuff, and I cucked him out. It was like, so I just got back from disarming bombs in Iraq. My childhood's fine. Let's talk about the real thing. But what I realized was that the combat stuff exacerbated a lot of childhood stuff. So for instance, as a child, I had problems. My parents divorced, and I was disengaged in school, even though I was intelligent. So my stepdad, you know, often told me that I just do the bare minimum, or I, you know, slough off or don't care to engage. And when the first people, when we were in Iraq and our first people died or got killed, it was like I developed this internal critic, this drill sergeant inside of me that was like, no, you need to, you make mistakes and you don't pay enough attention. So you need to like do it again. Do it with your eyes closed, put it back. I don't care. Like, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. You need to keep doing this. And so I had a lot of responsibility. I was convoy security as well. So I'd be like 1,000 meters out in front of the convoy trying to set up any ambushes or find IEDs. So I was always kind of in the front of the front. And I had to, in that time, it served me. I had to be that sharp. But when I came home, that carried on. And it would be, you know, any deadlines and things that I'm doing. And I'm not mean to other people. I don't freak out on other people. It's internal on me. And so everybody else sees that I'm calm. And they're like, oh, he's calm under pressure. But inside, I'm calm because I've beat myself up so much that I know it's going to go. It's going to be all right. And I've had to really unwind that.
Yeah. When you have that inner drill sergeant who's just pounding on you, I think we can all relate in some way, shape, or form, because I think all of us, we are our own worst critics. Like we can pick apart every little thing that we do and tell ourselves why it's not good enough, or it should have been faster or done better, or you know, whatever the thing is that you tell yourself. We all do that. And again, I think that's another survival type instinct that comes in. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know specifically, but it seems to me anyways, it kind of makes sense that it would be a survival type thing, because, you know, again, why wouldn't you want to do things the best that you can in absolute perfection? Why wouldn't you want it to be as fast as it can be done while still maintaining the quality of the work or whatever? Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to me too. But
it's definitely a survival mechanism.
Yeah.
It'll kick in and it serves its purpose. You don't just do it for no reason.
Yeah.
It serves its purpose in that time, but then we just carry it on and it goes subconscious and we never reprogram. We never change the process.
Right. And this is something that actually I've struggled with myself as well, you know, this perfectionism and trying to, you know, just do everything 100% and all that. And I, you know, a lot of it was, you know, hey, I don't want guys to die. And like, I got to do my job as best as I can in order to make sure that they don't. And my best has to be perfect. Otherwise it's not good enough. And you know, like that kind of mindset. And then recently I was thinking about this thing that happened to me in basic training. And I don't know why it popped in my head. It just kind of came to me. We were doing our rifle qualification in basic training. And the day before, there was like a practice qualification. It didn't count for anything. It was just, you went to the range and you shot. And I hit, out of the 40 targets, I must have hit like 38 of the 40 targets or something like that. Like I was smoking them, and I couldn't miss. Like I missed like two of them, but like I felt like I was just dialed in and everything was great. And I was feeling really good. Then the next day came qualification and I barely passed. I don't know what the hell happened, but I just barely made it. And I was beating myself up, and it was like, it was visible. Like people could tell I was angry and I was upset at myself. One of the drill sergeants pulled me aside. I was like, oh, I'm screwed. You know, like I'm going to get smoked. I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to get the whole rest of the platoon smoked, whatever. But this is like one of the like few times that the rare times that they talked to me like I was an actual person. Like, you know, not like a, you know, drill sergeant screaming in your face kind of thing. He's like, you know, what's going on? What's the problem? And, you know, I told him the same story I just told you. I was like, day before, I did damn near perfect. And today I barely passed. He's like, yeah, but you passed. You did what you needed to do. You came here and you passed. While it wasn't perfect, well, yesterday wasn't perfect either, but you passed. So, like, you know, take it as a win and move on. And, you know, you'll get a chance to qualify again. You're going to do that, you know, many times throughout your military career. And, you know, try to do better next time.
You know what you're capable of.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's something I need to work on, you know, and maybe it's the pressure. Maybe it was the pressure of the qualification, you know, maybe it was something like that. Just screwed me up in my head. But like that message of, hey, take it as a win. You passed. Like, you're good. Like, don't worry about it. It's not perfect, but so what? It doesn't need to be.
That's what I write about in the book is progress, not perfection. You know, if you're making progress, you're good. There's certain situations like we talked about, maybe in combat, where you might need to be perfect. Okay, but that's very far and few between.
Right.
And you need to be able to give yourself the grace and know that at least you prepared. You didn't just go in there, you know, hungover trying to shoot your qualification or something.
Right.
You know, I couldn't do that in boot camp anyways. But you know, you were training and you were doing your best. So if you're putting forth your best effort, and even if you have an off day, my coach, I used to play basketball, would shoot us, keep shooting. You know, if you miss, you're a good shooter. It doesn't matter. You might have an off night, but that doesn't mean you stop shooting.
Right.
You know, they'll go in eventually. You know what you're doing. And a lot of times we need to give ourselves that grace that, like, you made a mistake. You didn't maliciously do something.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I mean, even, you know, Michael Jordan missed shots, you know, and lost games. Like, but he's still like one of the greatest players of all time. And so like that to me is like, you can take someone who's damn near perfect and they're still going to have an off night. You know, maybe they weren't feeling 100%, or maybe they, you know, whatever. There are reasons and it's okay. You know, you just take it, you move on, and you know, maybe there's some lessons to be learned. Take those lessons, learn them, use them, apply them, and kind of move on, right?
You can always still apply continual learning without the meanness, without the, you know, you can strive to be better, but not be so attached to the outcome.
Yeah, without that inner drill sergeant who's you know, barking in your face or in your mind, I guess, in this case, and making you feel miserable about, you know, everything going on with you. And so now switching it from, you know, kind of mental side, I believe you also had some like physical pain as well after, you know, coming back home. How did that all, you know, what was the outcome of all that? Like, you know, did you struggle with that? Like how did you end up kind of working your way through it?
That's another tough one because it was unexplained for a while. I got back. The last 90 days of my tour, we worked with a vehicle it was like a prototype. It was a massive vehicle that used radiation to try to set off the bombs without anybody having to get out. So it would spray radiation at the ground and then try to activate the blasting cap or fry the material in the trigger. They didn't have a weapon system on top of it. Navy labs developed it quickly and they brought it over to our HAO and we're like, you just want to drive this thing down the road. Like nobody's going to blow this up. It looks different than anything we've ever deployed. And so we did rock convoy security as well at the time. And I told her I was in the Rat Pack, people that were out in front of the convoy by like 1,000 meters or a kilometer. So we asked them what the safe distance of the effective distance of the radiation was. They said it was like 500 meters. And you'd like 300 standoff if it blows up an IED. So that's like 800. So we did the same thing. We're like, all right, well, I can stay, do the same principles. I'll stay 1,000 meters out in front of you and we'll escort you while you test this thing. And they'd have to shut it off when we went under observation posts because friendly radiation. But the idea was that I'm eyeballing. I don't have a range finder. I don't have a Geiger counter. Just kind of looking back like, yeah, we're about to punch out a little more.
Right.
And But the flip side was those missions were easy because that thing always overheated. It was too big to go on like dangerous roads. And so I'm 21 and at the end of my tour, I'm like, these are caked. These missions are easy, like whatever. But I'm getting radiated at the and from behind. And I started to have stomach episodes of like stomach pain, nausea, vomiting. And I got home and they, you know, it's ulcers because you had a crazy job and it's likely that you have ulcers. And I did have ulcers too. So they're like, it'll go away. The ulcers went away, but I still had the episodes. And so then they were like, well, it's because you drink or, you know, this lifestyle stuff. So I changed some of that. And then they're like, well, it's because you're, you know, PTSD, it's all in your head. So, you know, that also helped me start to like get more into doing some counseling. So it wasn't bad, but eventually it continued to happen. I had my gallbladder removed and it was like, had really bad scar tissue, but I've never had gallstones and other anomalies and kind of weird things. And in 2021, they finally were like, all right, you're 100% permanent in total. And so dealing with that is a lot of anxiety about going places, feeling like a burden because it can happen out of nowhere. I'm like, oh, gotta go. You know, having to go to the hospital and needing pain medicine at times. And then, you know, being denied pain medicine by the hospital because the opioid crisis started and they're like, yeah, we don't give it out anymore.
Right.
So they try
right.
to like give me. Put me to sleep with like Benadryl and Xanax and different stuff. And now I'm just a zombie and still in pain.
So, yeah, that's, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, I totally understand the opioid crisis because I think they were overprescribed in some cases and that it wasn't very helpful in many cases, but there are maybe some more extreme cases where they are useful and they should be used, you know, cases like this where that's kind of, I mean, you're not going to pop an Advil and be fine, you know, or a Motrin or something, you know, like that's, and eventually that's going to start hurting your stomach and other organs too, if you're taking too much of that. So that's not the best idea either, but you know, eventually like you need to do something to manage the pain. You're probably having sleep issues. You're probably having, you know, other issues because you're just not able to manage the pain, you know, so what ended up, how did you end up kind of getting this to be manageable for you?
Well,
or is it still a work in progress?
Still a work in progress. It's led to suicidal ideations. It's led to a lot of dark feeling, kind of, like I said, a burden, not feeling worthy. So I've had to do a lot of acceptance work on, you know, not internalizing, maybe if a doctor says it's in your head and then I'm like, oh, why can't I figure this out? Or, you know, I know what happened. I know that this is something that I'll likely have to deal with.
Right.
And, you know, when we were talking about the opiate thing, it's like the pendulum always swings and never really kind of lays in the middle. And so it was really loose and then this pendulum swung to like really tight and it caught some people like myself in a, you know, in a bad situation where it actually created addiction instead of preventing. And so I used to just go to the emergency room when I needed to, once a month, twice a month, if it happened, got that bad, would be taken care of and I'd go home, I wouldn't be prescribed. And eventually after a few times of being like turned away and still being in pain, I turned to street dealers and I had smoked weed before. So I just talked to people and found some, so then I had them at the house, and when I'd get sick, I would take like Pedialyte to replicate the IV and the pain medicine, and then I could get prescribed the Zofran, so I could like replicate what they would do in the emergency room, and that worked for a little while. But I had them on hand at all times, and that got very self-justifying of, well, you know, my back hurts or whatever. Yeah. I was in school and working at the time too, so like, you know, justifications for reasons to take them outside of being sick. Mm-hmm. And then physical addiction sets in. And this whole time I'm working for the government now, and I'm a project manager, a pretty high level. I got to GS 13 step 5, which is like a It's a high-ranking officer, like a major, I believe, equivalent. But I was still able to function, get awards, get promoted, and go do all this stuff. So it's an easy to justification that it's not a problem. I'm paying my bills. Right. There's no problem. I legitimately have a reason to take them, and then sometimes I take them when I don't need them. But and then you're addicted physically, and you can't not take them. And so for a long time, I tried that. I was just taking enough to maintain not being sick, but I couldn't quit. So I ended up checking myself into rehab for 9 days during that time.
Okay. Now, for other folks who might have found themselves in the same position or might be in the same position right now, what advice do you have for them to maybe, like, you know, kind of learning from your mistakes, what advice do you have to, you know, help them navigate through this?
Chronic pain is difficult because it, like you said, it messes with your sleep, your mental health. And when you have physical pain and mental health, mental pain, you're very susceptible to addiction, mm-hmm. because opiates known bullets, and it would make it, you know, easier for me to kind of focus on school and do things that I needed to do. But it's a trap. It's like a smoke and mirrors. It quickly goes from being, wow, this is providing relief, to this is a ball and chain that I can't stop. And sure. So I think the mind-body connection, I didn't ever really understand how strong that was. And even with physical problems, having a stronger mental health, working on some of these things to reprogram your gratitude and your mindsets and your beliefs and things like that will calm your nervous system, and your body will release different chemicals, and you'll actually start to possibly have relief from some of the discomfort and maybe the frequency. I'm not saying it's going to fix it, but it can make it to where it's more tolerant.
And yeah, and maybe not the same intensity that mm-hmm. that it might have been before too. Yeah, and the medication, whether it's an opioid or some other medication, doesn't address the root cause of the problem, right? It covers up the symptoms of the problem to make it manageable and tolerable. And the way I look at that type of medication is, like, you're in pain, you know, you're at a 7, 8, 9, 10 on the pain scale, you know, on the higher end of that scale. And it's constant in many cases. And that's no way to live. So, okay, we need to bring it back down on that scale, down to like the twos and ones and like mm-hmm. that area, you know, maybe even zero. But, you know, so that way then we can, all right, at least you're not in pain, but now we can look at it and try to figure out what the root cause is and then address that root cause. Maybe there's a surgery that's needed, or maybe there's some other intervention that's needed to, you know, remove that root cause problem and fix it, you know, fix it once and for all, if possible. And then you won't need that medication going forward. You know, it's not like the medication doesn't fix the problem. It just makes the symptoms go away. And, you know, that's where I see, you know, and again, I'm not a doctor or anything like that, but that's where I would see this medication coming in, is like, let's make life tolerable for you now so we can then address the root cause of this. But I see a lot of times doctors are just prescribing people things, you know, some sort of pain medication, and then that's it. There's no, hey, you're feeling better? Okay, cool. Then the pain medication works, and
right.
We don't have to investigate any further. But that's only like the first step in my mind. Is
Band-Aids on bullet holes, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, yeah, sure, maybe it'll help for a few seconds, but that's not going to be a long-term solution.
The approach that you just described is definitely key, and I don't try to tell people not to take medicine.
Yeah.
In fact, you should, so that you can be in a comfortable place. But when you're in that comfortable place, don't just say, okay, now I'm comfortable.
Right.
Now you have to do the work to figure out the root cause.
And that's right.
Try to make it to where you don't have to take the medicine as much, or, you know, just like I said, progress. Try to make progress.
Yeah. And Now, I believe you also spent some time trying different modalities for, you know, healing and things like that. But what are some of the other things that you tried, and what were some of the practices or tools that made the biggest impact on your situation?
I've tried like a lot of different cognitive behavioral therapies, cranial sacral therapy, which is somewhat like Reiki. I've done like the brain scan thing where they, forget what it's called, and you have the brain thing on and you're watching a video and it had you focus on bringing your brain out of fight or flight.
Okay.
It's pretty interesting. And then EMDR, I really liked EMDR. So what I found was that it was weird at first, because it's a lot of like reprogramming. It has to do with like reimagining things in a different way and actually feeling. And it was a tough concept for me. So I'm like, that didn't really happen. So what are we doing? Why am I pretending like this? But if you think about it, it's a cool brain hack, and it's something that I use in a lot of different ways. Is your brain likes to prove itself right. So if you have a belief, if you have like a thought, and even if it's a bad one or a positive one, your brain is going to look for confirmation of that belief. So if it's like, I have bad luck, your brain's constantly scanning to be like, see, you got bad luck. So if you've ever watched like somebody get hurt in sports on TV, or thought of something really gross and had like an actual reaction to it, you get goosebumps when you see somebody roll their ankle or something. That didn't really happen, but you can imagine so viscerally what that feels like that you have the actual reaction. You can do that in positive too. So you can think of something so viscerally, so positively, and imagine it happen that your body will be tricked. It'll be tricked into believing that it actually happened or that it will happen. And so with positive affirmations, with gratitude practice, with writing like a mission statement and goals, those are ways that I combat these and reprogram these negative beliefs. So if I find myself negative self-talk, I look deeper. What's the belief that lies under? Why am I saying this?
Gotcha.
Okay, maybe I believe that if I make a mistake, someone's going to die. Okay, so now I have to reprogram that into like a positive affirmation that, and remind myself that that's not true, that I'm safe, you know? And then maybe that you don't feel worthy, because when you're young too, you develop these beliefs and your brain isn't fully developed to have like the thought process that you do now. And then it becomes a subconscious belief. If you were to think about that again today, you could easily be like, that's not true. You know what I mean? That's my dad's problems. That have nothing to do with me. But it's subconscious and it lies under there that like, I'm not lovable because my dad left me when I was young. Mm-hmm. And so that can come out in different ways in relationships. And then when I find that in either negative self-talk or triggers, when I get really upset about something, there's something underlying in subconscious. And then I'll try to reprogram those with the positive affirmations, gratitude, and the writing a mission statement to have different purposes to know how I want to show up for this.
Yeah, it's interesting how the brain works. And
it's crazy.
It's just a fascinating part of our body that, you know, I think we're only just scratching the surface of our understanding of what goes on in our brain. There's a lot that goes on, and then the reprogramming of your brain. I think programming is a really good word to use, because it's almost like a computer program where like one line of code that's wrong could throw off the whole thing and just throw you all out of balance, right? And then you get those positive things, that's someone going in and correcting some of those mistakes and getting that to become your go-to, your norm, your baseline is thinking of the positive, the good things instead of the negative things. Because you're right, the more you think negatively, the more negative you'll find.
And the law of attraction is that it happens.
And
It's a weird thing between your brain like looking for that because you believe it and you have this negative belief, and like the attraction of like kind of the energy you're putting up. If you go into a situation believing that people don't like you, you're going to treat them as if they already don't like you, and they're probably not going to like you.
Right. Yeah. And then you get that confirmation. That, yeah. Well, yeah, look, see, they didn't like me. And so I just must be unlovable, unlikable, whatever. I can't be anybody's friend. I can't be, romantically involved with anybody. I'm just not good enough for anybody, because that's the mindset that you end up developing, because you're trying to confirm this one time, and then it builds on itself.
Instead of trying to internalize those things, it's when you come across them, you got to debunk the code. You got to go figure out what is there, and don't get too upset and beat yourself up. Go back and figure out where that lies, and like you said, debug that code.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a kind of a interesting way to think of it. I don't know that I've ever really thought of it that way before, just now, the debugging the code, like you said. But as someone who I've done coding in my kind of previous careers, and it can be really frustrating when there's a bug in your code and you just don't know where it is and you're trying to figure it out, and you're just screwing around with a whole bunch of stuff trying to make things work. And sometimes you make it worse because you're not doing the right thing, but sometimes you make it better and you find that thing. And when you do, this is my experience anyways, but when this is not, figurative, like we're talking about the brain or anything, this is literal code that I'm talking about. But when I literally found the bug in the code and I fixed it, it felt great to be able to, I finally found it and I fixed it. Man, imagine how good that'll feel when you figure it out in your own brain.
One caveat is that definitely when you do find these things, it's like, I think G.I. Joe says, now you know, and knowing's half the battle.
So
you got half the battle done, because now you know, but you have to the reprogramming part is a little harder than just like retyping the code. The reprogramming part is the repetition of those positive affirmations, and it's not going to happen immediately just because you uncovered it. But you're halfway there, and you're so much closer than you were before when you start trying to find these things instead of doing the loop, like you said, and being like, see, I do have bad luck, and going down the spiral.
Right, exactly. I want to talk a little bit about your book for a minute here. It talks about focusing that on the internal growth and transforming your life through a lot of the stuff that we're talking about today, but tell us a little bit more about the book. I know you mentioned it a little bit earlier, but a little bit more about the book, what readers can expect from the book.
All right. Well, the name of it's Internal is Greater Than External, Calming the Chaos Within. And the idea is it's tactics and techniques, behaviors of how to, I'll say, inventory your subconscious, like we were talking about, for fears, negative beliefs, negative mindsets, attitudes, expectations, and things that you actually have control over. And you're going to find these things, and we're going to reprogram them with positive affirmations, writing a personal mission statement, gratitude practice, repentance and forgiveness to get rid of like some of the guilt and shame with ourselves, and really learning how to love ourselves again and be nicer to ourselves and have an internal fortitude that where when your external world changes, you're still okay. A lot of times one of the things I did when I moved here, I moved to Costa Rica. I told you I was a GS-13. I was, making six figures. Then I'm a pretty high status in my job. I had a lot of external things that I accomplished and still felt hollow and still had the problems inside. And it provided temporary happiness, temporary, woohoo, I accomplished my goal. I made it to Costa Rica. And then 2 weeks in, I'm feeling even worse because now I'm depressed in paradise. So I have to focus inward on why am I depressed instead of trying to fix the depression with changing the external world.
Yeah. On paper, it would seem like you got it all. You had the good job, you're living in paradise, you're doing all the things that seemingly would be like, hey, man, why wouldn't this guy be happy? But
yet the thought of taking my life had crossed my mind. So,
yeah. And that's the reality of this internal struggle that's going on in the mind, is that even though everything seemingly is going great, you might have great job, great family life, great, you're living in the, your paradise, you know, Costa Rica might not be everybody's paradise, but wherever it is that is your paradise, that might be there. You have all the material things that you want. Everything seems to be going great for you, but inside you're killing yourself literally because you're just battling these demons that are in your head, that it's a tough battle because they know how to really, they know you the best and they know how to really dig into you and
you know make yourself it suck. The best.
Yeah.
You just reminded me of something I wanted to say about the battle with ourselves. As soldiers, we're trained to eliminate the threat and we're trained to fight with violence. And this is not the same fight. You're fighting with yourself. And that's where I got to the point, like, I'll just be honest, where it was like, I need to eliminate this threat because it was a threat to my life, right? This PTSD stuff, this bubbling up and causing all these problems. And it was like, the way I know how to fight is to hurt the thing I'm fighting, and I'm fighting myself. So that's not a way to fight this battle. And this battle needs to be fought. There's mental health warriors. We need more of them. And I think that it needs to be fought a lot softer and with a lot more grace and self-love. And it's not a style that we're used to associating with battle.
I remember when I was in Afghanistan, there was this whole push to win over the hearts and minds of the local people. And as an infantry guy, I was like, wait a minute. You just spent, you know, how much time training me how to go kicking doors and kill people.
Yeah.
And now I have to go be kind and gentle and warm and fuzzy. And I don't know, you want me to drop off a teddy bear to, you know, to them too, or something like, it just didn't make any sense to me. But when you look at the big picture, the overall strategy of what they're trying to do, it does make sense. That campaign of winning over the hearts and minds, but in a way, I felt like I wasn't the right guy for the job. Neither were the guys that I was with, because like we were the door kickers. We were the guys who go pull triggers and, you know, do all the things that movies end up getting made out of. You know, but
call them the nice guys if you want.
go get the, I don't know, somebody, I was going to say
the MWR guys or something.
Yeah, there you go. They'll call those people in and have them go hang out with the population. They'll build a rec center. They'll have basketball courts. They'll have all sorts of stuff, movie theaters and stuff. I mean, they'll start winning over hearts and minds real quick. We didn't do any of that crap for those people. But it's a different style of fighting. I guess that's my point for bringing that up is... Yeah. It's a different way of looking at it. And maybe we weren't trained very well for that hearts and minds campaign. And I'm fairly certain we weren't. I don't think we did a great job at it. But it's another tactic. It's another thing to keep in the tool belt. Now, whether or not it was effective in combat, I don't know. You know, I don't know that effectiveness. But with you're right, with your own mind, there's definitely a time to be gentle with yourself. Yeah, sure. Be hard on yourself in certain circumstances.
Right.
Like in a do or die kind of situation. It needs to be done. Okay. It has to, or lives are going to get lost. Then yes, be hard on yourself. Make sure it gets done right. And, you know, make sure that you're doing everything that you need to do in order to get it done the right way. But I mean, like, so what, you make a mistake on, I don't know, filling out some paperwork or something, you know?
I learned this with the bomb stuff, is that nerves are good to get you prepared, but they're not good when you're performed, when you're operating. And so there's this thin line between nervousness before And then when it's time to go, you have to be able to close that gap and be like, all right, this isn't going to serve me anymore. I've prepared as much as I can prepare, and now it's time to go. Because if I'm sitting here thinking about all the things that I might mess up, like the example with you shooting, when you shot with no pressure, you did great. And when the next day, when you're thinking about everything that can go wrong with all that pressure, you were hindered a little bit. And so if you can have that pressure all the way up until it's time to go, and then take a moment to make yourself aware and conscious, like, okay, I'm good. I'm confident that I've done the best that I can do, and I'm gonna perform now.
Yeah, 100%. Just a different way of fighting. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, for anyone who's listening, who feels stuck, like they're just spinning their wheels and not really getting anywhere, despite the fact that they feel like they're trying. Maybe it's addiction, maybe it's PTSD issues, anger, just feeling, I don't know, lost in the world. I think this is the way to go, is to, like, if you've been hard on yourself and you're beating yourself up all the time, well, that clearly isn't working. Let's try something else. Because I think that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. You know, it just doesn't work that way. And so, like, yeah, try something different. Like, yeah, you've been hard on yourself this whole time, and that you've gotten real good at being hard on yourself. You flex that muscle enough, you're going to get good at it. But let's try flexing some other muscle and try the kinder, gentler approach. And I know for all us infantry guys and, service members, they're going to be like, oh man, the softer side of things. Come on, whatever, man. You know, but I know. Seriously, like, and come on, like, you've been there. I've been there, where we had that same thought, but that
namby-pamby bullshit.
I don't want to deal with that shit. Like, come on. But I mean, the other stuff wasn't working.
I'm telling you, the ego is the one that drives that. This voice in your head, it's like, this is weak. That's why the first chapter in my book is humility. And so learning to accept that actually you can be still retain all of your masculinity and work on your mental health and do some of the softer stuff.
Right. And I think actually it increases the masculinity.
It does.
By being able to do that, because you're in control. When you're angry all the time and you're flipping out and you're out of control and you're, God forbid, you're throwing things or, you know, hurting people or things like that, and your anger is just way out of control, you might feel like you're a big, strong, masculine man, but you're really not. You're weak in other areas. Physical, you might be physically strong, but you might be weak in some other areas that you need to work on those. And the monster can come outside of you when and be unleashed when it's necessary. Right. You're getting attacked, you're getting robbed or mugged, or you're having an issue, man, unleash the beast and let that out and let it fly. No problem. 100%. But you're having an argument with your spouse or, you know, your kids or something like that. Mm-hmm. Keep that shit inside. Like, you don't need to unleash that beast. There is no need for that in those kind of situations. And I was just going to say that's being masculine right there, is being able to control it. So
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you find yourself with those triggers where you're getting overly upset about something, there's always a stimulus. So it's not like you're just flying off the handle for no reason.
Right.
But the level of kind of response that you're giving to the stimulus is out of alignment, out of proportion, disproportionate. That's where you can look inward for what negative belief, what is causing this reaction, and try to reprogram it. Because like you were saying, masculinity, I used to be thrown off quickly. I quick trigger and you could, but that's you're getting me out of my alignment, and you're in control of my emotions instead of me being in control of them. And that's not a good place to be.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you're out of control literally in that situation, because somebody else is pulling the strings. And
yeah, somebody who doesn't even know me can say something stupid and I'm, wow, I'm gone.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and they're living rent-free in your head and they're able to control what your reaction is in one way, shape, or form. And that's not the place to be. I mean, look, I don't pretend to have it all figured out, you know, and I don't think you do either. I mean, based on this conversation, none of us have it. We're not experts or have figured out everything in life. And I think that's okay. Like, this is all part of a process. We're going to learn new things as we go and get better. If I get, you know, a little bit better today than I was yesterday, great. A little bit better tomorrow, great. And then just continue trying to work on things. Never going to be perfect. And I think the pressure of perfection is too much for anybody to handle, you know, all the time, you know, when everything has to be just so and just perfect. You got to let some of that go, right?
I almost didn't write this book, or I almost didn't publish this book because of fears. And then those fears get justified into negative self-talk. Like, who are you to talk to people about my thoughts? You're still effed up. You're, you know, you still struggle. You still, you know, have problems.
Yeah, right.
Why would somebody want to listen to you? And then it's not perfection, though. If I look back at where I came from and where I'm at now, yeah, there's a lot of value that I can bring to the conversation. And it took a lot for me to accept that or to allow myself to not be perfect and still move forward.
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely letting go of that perfection is important for all of us. I still deal with that myself and I have to figure it out. And again, not perfect. I'll make mistakes. I'm aware of this problem. And so I try to not let it be as big of a problem as it you know, it used to be, but I still am figuring it out and that's fine. I'll get there eventually. I'll be able to figure out how to control that and manage it. But you know, other people, it might be at different places in this whole journey, and just know that exactly what you just said, you know, figuring out how to manage that negative self-talk and replace it with something more positive is really, it's the way to go.
Everybody has problems and, you know, everybody has, so it's not a matter, not everybody's aware of it.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, at least being aware of it is a plus. If you're aware, then you, as long as you're not doing these things on purpose, and that's why I talked about repentance and forgiveness too, is that's part of that confidence and not being so mean to myself, is I will apologize. You know, I need to mess up. I messed up, yeah. But it's okay. And I forgive myself.
And like you said, knowing it's half the battle.
Yeah.
So
still got to do the rest.
Still got to do the rest. Yeah. There's a lot of work ahead. So yeah, definitely be aware of this issue. I'm glad that you did overcome that issue and you did publish your book. It's out there now for folks to read. For the listeners who maybe want to get a copy of your book, where can they find it? And, you know, where can they go if they want to learn more about, you know, kind of your work and what you do?
The book's called Internal is Greater Than External, or Internal with the Greater Than Sign, External, Calming the Chaos Within. But if you just search Cole Grace, ColeGrace on Amazon, the book will come up.
Excellent.
And then I have a YouTube channel, which is at cgrace21. And I've been doing videos about the different chapters in the books and some of the different mental health concepts. And just recently I started doing a kind of book tour, a podcast book tour. So I have some podcasts lined up in the next couple months. I'm just kind of talking about on different podcasts that align with the message. And yeah, trying to spread the word, man. That's important.
It is.
For men, for soldiers, and to understand that this stuff is an important piece, to have a piece.
That's a good way to put it. The link to the book and your YouTube channel, I'll put those in the show notes. Cole, I really do appreciate you coming on the show. And I thank you for opening up and sharing your experiences, the things that you went through and how you're working on them and dealing with them. I think your dedication to helping other folks find their way out of this darkness is definitely something that is commendable. So thank you so much for all of that and for coming on the show. I really did enjoy this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. That was my honor.